everybody.
Welcome to the first of our After Hours show. What you'll find here is all the kind of the bits we cut out of the main podcast, things which aren't appropriate or they kind of stray too far or go on too long. We try and cut them out, and usually they just go in the bin somewhere. But what I decided to do, just to try this out, see if you like it. We're going to have basically different clips separated by a bit of music or something like that. And then you have a listen and see what you missed. Enjoy.
Outtakes.
Outtakes or something like that. But we're not really outtakes in the sense that it's funny or anything like that.
Oh, come on, this is all funny.
You know, that quote is going to be at the beginning of that outtakes thing now.
I hope so.
It's all comedy gold.
It's comedy gold, man. Hey, I have a news item. So while you're slicing and stuff together,
slicing
and splicing, Skyrim.
Oh, it's Skyrim, yes. Oh,
yes, the next in the Elder Scrolls. I can't believe I didn't remember that.
It's going to be fun to play. That's all I know. That's all I care about. It's going to be fun.
I hope so.
I mean, the thing is, though, we may have been disappointed in some of the features of the Elder Scrolls games, but I've not played any of them for less than 80 hours.
Right. And this looks like another one of those games. My only fear is that they fall into the BioWare trap of making it a little too mainstream and a little bit too cinematic and a little less... you know, the one thing about setting it in Skyrim is how explory can it be when...
It's quite a small continent, isn't it? Or part of the continent.
Yeah.
If you look at the big map.
And they're all it's all mountainous, right? I mean, that's what it is.
Whoa, what the hell was that?
Ooh. You should put that at the beginning of the podcast.
Woo woo!
What the hell was that?
What the hell? It's like an alien invasion kind of thing.
But yeah, I'm really looking forward to this. That's probably got me pumped as anything that's coming out this year.
Is it coming out this year or next year?
Yeah, fall, man. 11-1-11, I think, or maybe 11-11-11, like everything else.
Because I wasn't worried about it until you mentioned then that they've been really, really hammering home the cinematic nature of the game, shouting down dragons and stuff like that.
Right.
And that actually, now I am a little bit concerned.
Yeah.
I wasn't before.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. My optimism was misplaced.
Well, and it may be, you know, it's still, you know...
It's going to be a good game. It's going to be a good game. I know it's going to be a good game.
It's still Bethesda. It seems like they've done, from what I've read, some interesting things. Taken out some, you know, people were up in arms about it. But, you know, they've streamlined some of the, you know, kind of vestigial, characteristics and stats.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds good to me. Yeah, yeah.
Everything I've read,
the classes and stuff like that.
Yeah, it seems like they made some good trade-offs there.
As long as they bring back morph or transmorph, what you call it, then I'm it's gold. I don't care.
Yeah.
No, I don't really care about that. But that was a big thing about Oblivion, wasn't it? Like, I mean, okay, I didn't like what they did with the magic system in Oblivion. They made it too simplified compared to what it was in Morrowind.
Yes.
But there was a big, massive, massive uproar from like the core fans of the Elder Scrolls games about how they'd taken out the morphing spell, what's it called? I can't remember what it's called. So much so that people added it back in as like a mod.
Yeah. Well, they put levitation back in as well.
Oh, did they? I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah, I believe I read that somewhere.
See actually, I thought levitation was a spell they should have left in. Okay, it breaks the gameplay, but that's the point of you don't play the Elder Scrolls games to be limited. You play it to be unlimited, to break things, you know what I mean, and break in and whatever.
Yes, exactly. I mean that did make me sad when they take, you know, trust your customer, right?
Yeah.
Trust the people who are playing the game. You know, if they want to break it, let them break it.
Yeah.
Put stuff, you know, keep stuff in that lets
it's
them do
fun
stuff like
as
that.
Well.
Oh yeah, it's fun
being
as well.
Being able to fly is fun.
Oh yeah.
There's this great story. I was traveling through the mountains in Morrowind, And I was just, you know, kind of exploring to see, and I thought, okay, I'm going to go over there, so I'll take a shortcut across these big, massive peaks. And I went up, and I fell in between these two massive peaks. I couldn't get out. I was there for about 15 minutes. I hadn't saved for maybe like an hour or something. I just didn't want to go. I did not want to go back and redo everything I'd done. And then I just thought, okay, let's have a look what I've got in my inventory. Go through my inventory, because then crossing Morrowind, even in Oblivion, you have so much crap, don't you? You know, kind of it replicated in Morrowind. It couldn't stack and stuff like that. And then I saw it. There was a staff which had levitation as one of its abilities. And it would cast it for 30 seconds. And
right.
I equipped this staff and hit the spell. And you know how slow levitation was in Morrowind, don't you?
Right.
It was like, you know, it was probably slower than walking, like in a vertical line anyway. And it took me literally like 30 seconds to get out of this thing. I only just had enough to get to the cusp. And then I had to kind of jump, scramble out the top. But if that hadn't been in the game, I would have just been stuck and I had to reload. There were instances like that in Oblivion.
Yeah,
you could get stuck and that was it. You know, you had to reload.
Yeah, I remember in Morrowind I had a medallion of levitation, constant levitation.
Mm.
And so it's at some point, you know, if I did, it made it really cool to be able to get all the way around that island. You just go and it's like, you know, screw these mountains, these impassable mountains. Let's just go, you know, I need to go from here to there. I don't need the fast travel. I'll just levitate and wind walk over there. It's awesome. It's so awesome. You know, I'm glad I hope they really do add that back, and stuff like that. I mean,
yeah. Okay. Make it expensive. Because making
money, yeah.
it isn't hard to do once you get to higher levels. Don't make it so you have it level one, but
right.
You know, at least put it in so it's there to mess around with.
Well, that's the best thing about the Bethesda games is, you know, when you get to level 30 or 35, I mean, you're such a, you should be such a badass that you can, there's not a whole lot of left of combat to challenge you, but that's okay, because guess what? Level one sucks. Level one is hard, where rats can kill you. Right, and that's your payoff.
I'm thinking about now as well. Morrowind had negatives as well that could hinder your play. You could get the vampire virus, and you could get the leprosy, whatever it was, porphyrism or something. And then they also have things like the boots of blinding speed. So you could run really fast everywhere, but you couldn't see where you're going. It's using
right.
things like that are fun. You know, they add to what you remember about the game and. They weren't in. I mean, okay, they had vampirism in Oblivion, but I don't think it really impacted you in any negative way.
I don't think it did.
I mean, it made you more ugly. But right. that was about it.
Well, and vampirism has been a staple of that series. I mean,
yeah.
They had that in the first game, if I remember correctly. And in the second game, they had a whole huge plot. If you became a vampire... you know, they had a whole swath of the game that was just, you would only access if you actually, you know, contracted vampirism.
Oh, okay.
It was really cool. It'd be nice to see if they could get back to some of that sort of thing.
Hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Like we talked about before, content that you don't see is really cool, that you may not see is really cool when you stumble upon it.
Yeah. I know some people are completionists, but I'm really not.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's your story. It's not about trying to experience everything. It's trying to experience your story. It's your life kind of thing.
Right. Exactly right. And it's not, you know, to take it back to BioWare, it's not about force feeding you all the content, right?
Yeah.
It's about, here's my story. Here's all the cool things that happened to me and that is probably different from what happened to you.
Yeah. Which is a little bit sad that, you know, going back to the Mass Effect 2, how your decisions in the first one didn't really affect anything in the second game. Like, whether you killed the council or not, you still sided with Cerberus.
Yeah.
You know that kind of thing would have been interesting to have.
Yeah, I was very disappointed in that, because the way they made it sound, you know, before it was released was like, yeah, all of your, you know, you have a big impact on how the second game plays out. It turns out, no, you don't really at all.
Yeah.
You understand why that is, but
it makes it easier to develop, doesn't it?
Right.
That is the simplest reason. Because it's difficult. I mean, even in one single game, to link all those things together and have a consequence is difficult. To do it between games is going to be incredibly hard.
Right. But I don't care if it's hard or not.
That's what they promised, yeah?
Yeah, that's what they promised, and they just really under-delivered big time on that.
Yeah. Actually, I've got a bit, you know, talk about the combat before. Interesting side note is that you can holster your weapon, but I can't think of any reason why you would.
Right.
Because you don't run faster.
Right.
And you can't fight without your weapon. And you can't draw your weapon when you're not in combat.
Right. And nobody seems to get freaked out that you're waving a loaded, you know, pulse rifle in their face, right?
Yeah.
Which is the reason I always thought was interesting in RPGs when you're running around with a drawn sword and people start freaking out in games that have that.
Yeah.
And you have to holster it. That's the only reason why you have a holster mechanic, in my opinion.
Yeah. Because otherwise it doesn't affect the game at all.
Right.
So I just couldn't figure out why they put it in. I was just wondering whether you had any insight into that.
I mean, one cool thing about in Far Cry 2 was, if you were in one of the safe zones...
Oh, yeah, you had your weapon on, yeah.
And you had your weapon, but it was down. But you could pull it up. You could pull it up.
Yeah.
And people would start getting agitated. And then if you kept it up too long, even if you didn't shoot anybody, eventually they would start shooting at you.
Yeah.
They would just figure that you were about to go off and take some preemptive action. I thought that was so awesome the first time it happened.
Yeah.
Even though I had to reload a save. But it was just awesome because I just, you know, because as you gain reputation, people get scared of you, right? So I just, you know, one time I'd just go in and start walking in front of people and hear what they had to say. And so I wanted to see what would happen if I lifted my gun. I raised my gun and sighted this guy. He started saying, "Hey, you know, why are you doing this? What's up?" And I just kept it up and he kept on gesticulating. And then all these other guys started coming around, gathering around me. And then eventually
they actually gather around you before they start opening fire.
Yeah. Everybody starts seeing guys coming towards you. And then all of a sudden, just somebody starts shooting at you. They're like, "Whoa, what just happened? That's awesome."
That is pretty cool, actually. Fair enough. Maybe they start firing at you, but having them gather around you to make sure that you're behaving in line and intimidating you effectively. That's pretty cool, actually. That's cool. That's cool. It's cool.
It was pretty cool. That's such a good game.
I'm such a straight player. I never encountered that.
I just, you know, one of the cool things about that game is there's so many little touches like that that you might not ever see, but if you just, you know, happen to stumble across it, it allows you to experiment a lot.
Yeah.
And see some of these little pieces of content that you might not otherwise see it. It's just awesome. That's just great here.
Games are much more, it's not simplified, although they are simplified to an extent, but the player isn't allowed to have any negative or failing qualities in the game. They're not allowed to come back from a failure. It's always about advancing and making yourself stronger. It's kind of Dragon Ball Z syndrome.
Right.
You know, you're there sitting there going, "Wah!" for like 20 hours.
Yeah.
And slowly your power increases probably a constant rate. It's probably not even exponential.
Right.
And, you get to the end of the game and that's it. You know, you've not really accomplished much.
Right. Yeah, I guess that's why I keep playing old games.
Good old games.
Yeah, Star Control 2 is on Good Old Games, by the way.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, you don't know Star Control 2?
No.
Ooh. It's one of these games that's very hard to... It's from the 90s. It's very hard to explain what it is. Is it an RPG? Is it a space strategy game? Is it a space combat game? It's got a lot of the, you know, it just really kind of, you know, back before everything became a genre, it was just kind of, they tossed a bunch of stuff in. Yeah. You know, if you got an extra $6, you know, burn a hole in your pocket.
I'm not sure I can buy anything from there. I don't know. I'll have to look. Because
you should be able to get on Good Old Games.
No, it's because of my bank situation.
Oh.
Because I've got my address in Malta, I can't buy stuff properly. It's really annoying. The only thing I can buy reliably from is Steam.
That's weird.
Yeah, it's to do with like money laundering and stuff like that. Like they don't like having your address in a different country, as to where your bank is. Yeah.
Right.
Which is stupid, really. But yeah. I mean, I guess people do money, you know, launder money that way. They put money into different businesses and stuff like that. And because it's in a different country, the different laws can make it difficult to reclaim the money they've lost. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But Steam doesn't seem to care.
Yeah, they don't care. I mean, this game is about exploration, and I mean, essentially you start at Earth. And there's just so many different kind of mechanics in this game. I mean, one is building out your ship. Another one is you actually land on planets and you go pick up resources off of planets.
Okay.
And you can sell them to upgrade your ship. But
that sounds a bit like Mass Effect 2. That's good.
It kind of is, except you can't sell the resources.
Oh, that's true.
But yeah, I guess to draw somewhat of a parallel, right? I mean, there's a lot of interactivity. There's a lot of different paths. I mean, you can be a renegade or a nice guy. The whole idea is that, you know, this master race is taking over the galaxy, and you happen to have been away. They don't really explain that part of it very well. But you come back with this ship that has, you know, Prothean technology. It's not the Protheans, but basically that's what it is. And
I think they call them the precursors, don't they?
I think that's right.
Someone was mentioning Star Control 2 recently, and I went to have a look at the Wikipedia article of it. And it was quite confusing because I didn't have any knowledge of it.
But yeah, the precursors is exactly right. And you come back, and the first thing you do is you're supposed to help free Earth. And then they have a huge universe that you just tool around, and you find stuff and you fight stuff and you try to get allies on your side to go take on the Urquan Masters. There's actually a free version on the internet somewhere. I can't remember where it is, but basically they ported this to the 3DO. Okay. And they made that source code available for free, and so people took it and, you know, up-resed some of the stuff, and so you should be able to grab that if you're interested. I don't know if you're interested or not, but it's good.
No, it's
a pretty good game. I don't remember a lot of the details on it. It's been a long time, but I did pick it up this week at GOG. So
that actually sounds like the storyline to Mass Effect, as in the whole series.
It kind of does.
Which is quite funny, really.
You know, and I do remember the resource gathering, while really cool, is also can be kind of a pain in the ass, too. So, you know, similar to Mass Effect 2. Thank you. So one of the games I've been trying to get into is Metro 2033.
Oh yeah, you said it's hard, that game, apparently.
It is hard. And
you like your hard games, don't you?
I like it hard. I don't know. I'm having a hard time getting into it. I've just played the very first section about a month ago. According to Steam. I don't know.
Did you play the original Stalker?
I did for a bit. I had a hard time getting into that one too.
Uh-huh, okay. Because this is by half the team or something, like half the team left before the studio or something like that.
Yeah,
I want to play that game as well. People vacillate between loving it and saying this is what Stalker could have been if it was more linear, and saying it's really badly designed.
Yeah, which is interesting, you know, if you get a game that has, you know, that such a dichotomy of opinions.
Yeah.
There's something there, right?
Definitely.
Right now, I'm kind of falling on the badly designed side of things, but it might just be that I don't know what the hell I'm doing.
Because I've heard the, what to call it, the ammo system, the selling of ammo really hurts you.
Well,
you need stuff.
people, you know, I think that might be, you know, kind of the core thing that makes people go one way or another, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because in one sense, it's fascinating, right? That if you want more firepower, you shoot your money.
Yeah.
So that makes you, you know, have to think about, you know, how much do I really need this extra firepower?
And it actually makes sense in a lot of ways as well.
Yeah, it does.
If you think about in the old days, your sword, you know, if you had a sword, you were ready to fight. Whereas, I suppose, in modern days now, you need guns. But, of course, as ammunition becomes more scarce, that would then become more as a commodity because, you know, it'd be worth more.
Yes.
So that actually makes a lot of sense to me. I don't know whether it's fun as a gameplay mechanic.
Yeah, and some people hate it, and some people really like it.
Yeah.
I haven't gotten far enough into it's had any effect on me, really. It's odd because it's very kind of railroady.
Okay, it's really kind of like Half-Life 2 kind of thing, is it?
Sort of, except there are parts that aren't railroady at all. So you can, you know, so again, I've only played the very first section, so I don't know how true this is for the rest of the game, but,
okay,
you know, so they're like, okay, you need to go do this, you need to go do this, you need to go do this, and they kind of push you along, but you can always kind of stop and wander around, and, you know, there's a lot of ambient chatter and stuff going on, that's there for you to see if you want to go explore a little bit.
Yeah. Honestly,
I'm
getting a bit fed up with games that do that, where it's, oh, I've got to do this quick. And that's like someone's always shouting at you or something, reminding you. Actually, you can just go off like 30 hours and do something else.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if there's 30 hours, but...
Well, no. I mean, I'm exaggerating there.
Yeah, but it's...
Either make it urgent or don't.
Right. I mean, it's obviously, there's a lot of scripted things. Like there's an encounter very early on that, you know, you kind of, you know, if you mosey your way into the encounter area, this thing happens, but, you know, you don't have to mosey on in there until you're good and damn ready.
I heard in here there's some monsters to be shot. My Midwest America isn't so good.
That's a good accent for you, I think.
Maybe for the next podcast, I'll have that down pat.
I look forward to that, actually.
Actually, that would probably break my brain if I had to talk a lot for a long time.
But the other part that's interesting is it's very much a shooter, right? But it's also there's a lot of horror elements in it.
Okay.
It's very atmospheric, and there are parts that are just quite scary, actually.
Are the kind of the enemies, are they quite scary, or are they? Because I don't quite. You can spoil it for me. I'm not really bothered about that. But from what I've seen, or because I haven't watched any kind of videos or anything, but from what I've seen of what people have written, it's like kind of some kind of post-apocalyptic horrors force people underneath the earth, and I don't know whether they're mutated humans or something, or what's the kind of gist of the kind of the enemy.
Well, so the idea is that, yeah, it's post-apocalyptic. Everybody's living, you know, this takes place in the Moscow subway system.
Yeah.
Right? That's where people live now, because the surface world is uninhabitable. And then, I don't know if they're mutated humans, or if they're mutated animals, or if they're just, you know, something that, you know, the developers made up. But I get the sense that there's probably mutated animals and mutated humans. There's different enemy types.
Okay.
But they're trying to break into the subway system.
So you're actually sealed in?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, okay.
I mean, you can still get out, but they're like airlocks and they're guards and stuff. And part of you know, the first piece of it is, you know, your first big thing that you do is you travel to, you know, the next, I don't know, city, subway stop where people are staying in order to, you know, you're supposed to be helping take some supplies over to this other subway stop. And, of course, on the way you meet up with some bad guys. And it's very odd because it's, in a way, I don't know if you can succeed in the mission, because it's just you and three other dudes, and you have a gun, and monsters come, and you know you're pedaling. You know they have it's a hand car basically, and they're pedaling as fast as they can. And the monsters come at you, and then I ended up getting what I thought was killed. I'm cursing under my breath and got ready to do a save game, and then I wake up and we're there, and everybody else died. And now you're on this, you know, now that's your next thing. And then that's when I put the game down, so I don't know what happens next. I'm having a hard time getting used to the controls. And this always had trouble with this in Stalker, which is what put me off, was, you know, when things can go bad quickly, if you can't trust your controls.
I don't understand what you mean. Like,
so, like,
how the controls difference?
Well, there's a lot of... there's a lot of fiddly bits that you can do, right? So you can bring up a clock, bring up your watch. You can open up, you know, your backpack. Okay. You can, you know, there's about 15 different things that you can do. And I'm having a hard time getting good keybinds to let me do all the stuff that you need to do. So it's a complex game from a control standpoint.
It's like switching between AP or whatever, ammo and stuff like that. And then you can bring up your sight if you want to, or you can...
Right.
Yeah, I remember that from Stalker. I didn't use that so much in Stalker. It was there. I just kind of
I didn't really bother. You know, like there's a lighter, and there's like a flashlight, and there's just all kinds of different things, and I don't know what's important yet or not.
Yeah.
And I'm having a hard time wrapping my tiny brain around all the different things that you can do. And so you're in the middle of a firefight, you accidentally press flashlight.
Oh, no.
Pisses me off.
And it basically makes you a vulnerable idiot.
Right, and I'm just, and you look like an idiot too.
imagine that in a real fight. It's like people going, come on, stealth. And see, someone pulls out the flashlight, hello.
Yeah. Probably just shoot you, right? I mean, so, you know, and I'm getting to the point where I don't have a lot of patience to kind of work through that sort of thing. So that's why I put it on the shelf after I got through this little section. I don't want to have to learn another odd control scheme.
I think that's the big difference, really, between like a mature studio like Valve, who can probably, you know, help more kind of budding developers understand these things.
Right.
And maybe like a more rough and ready Eastern studio, they have more interesting ideas, and they'll think more outside the box. But then the kind of the interfaces tend to be a bit more rough, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably a fair thing.
But I mean, at the same time, you do get many more. Well, it feels that way. You get many more, like kind of what's the word I'm looking for? Not exploratory. Kind of like individual. Can't speak. Individualistic games,
right,
from those Eastern developers. You get things like Pathologic, which I haven't played. And there's this new one, Cargo. I don't know if you've seen it.
Mm-mm.
Where you have a little fat man, you have to punt around by the, like, kicking him up the ass, and like and like sticking together, like kind of like Banjo Kazooie nuts and bolts, and make them have fun in inverted commas, to get like points and stuff like that. I think that you just wouldn't get that from like probably an American developer or an English developer, because it probably wouldn't sell, or you know you wouldn't get any investments.
Right.
But they seem to be able to do it somehow. I'm not sure how.
Yeah, I think you're right. So I don't know if I like it or not. But I'll probably have more to say in the non-after-hours portion of our podcast next time.
That's fine.
Because I want to get back to it. There's got to be something there if it's so divisive, right? If there's so many people who either hate it or like it.
And people said it got good write-ups as well in various. I think Rock Paper Shotgun gave it a good write-up.
Yeah.
So and they're usually quite spot on in their kind of criticism of games.
Yeah. Well, this got gifted to me on Steam, so it didn't cost me any money, which I
Cool. Who gave you that?
Tannhauser.
Oh, okay.
He got it for free for, some bundle deal. And,
that's cool.
I can't remember exactly which game he had picked up, but evidently it was a toss-in. And
that's always cool, actually, because, I mean, quite a few times you buy stuff on Steam, and if you've already got it, you don't get the chance to give it off to someone else. You
just
lose the extra license.
Right. And so in this case, he was able to gift it, which I appreciate.
Yeah, that's cool.
But I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna play through it. So maybe what are you gonna be playing aside from Dragon Origins?
I didn't mention them before because I guess we got out of time, didn't we? We talked a lot about different things, but I'm playing Enslaved.
Oh, okay.
Which I'll talk about next time. I played the Prince of Persia trilogy, which I don't really need to talk about, because I wrote about it on the blog.
Right.
But also Venetica. I don't know if you heard of it.
Venetica. Sounds familiar.
It's really... I don't know whether they're quite a small development studio or whatever, but it's an RPG in the sense of maybe Zelda or Fable, maybe. But it's... If I don't know if the developer's actually English, but it feels really English, as if it was like kind of inspired by Terry Pratchett or something like that.
Okay.
And the writing is quite sarcastic and self-deprecating humour and stuff like that. And the voice, it's a B or a double A game. I'm not sure which yet.
Uh-huh.
Because it kind of oscillates between being not a triple A game, but a double A game. And being like a B-movie kind of thing. Because, the voice acting isn't very good in a lot of ways. But at the same time, it's all real English accents. It's not some kind of parody of an English accent. It's not like, oh, toot toot, oh, or like, a stupid thing like in Fable where everyone's like, who are me, Artie?
Right.
It's just no one talks like that. It's like actual real English people have voiced this game, which is quite interesting for me because it never happens. It's usually always American voice actors or people with a proper Queen's English accents.
Right.
So that's quite interesting. And then the combat system works as well. It's a bit rough. Things aren't really explained to you properly. It kind of suffers from what you'd feel as not enough money and not enough time. And there were small bugs in there as well. Like sometimes people don't speak their lines. It's funny, it hasn't happened recently, but when I first started playing, they would, every other line, they would make the head movements and the hand movements and stuff, and because I was playing with subtitles, so I could see what they were saying, but they wouldn't say anything, the mouth wouldn't move, and then you'd skip to the next line, and then the mouth would start moving and they'd talk. So it was just like a really, really funny bug. It was really, really funny.
Oh, man. Germans.
Are they Germans, are they?
Yeah, Germans, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, yeah. But it's the story reminds me a lot of one of the Terry Pratchett novels, because Death has a daughter kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And that's what she is. She's Death's daughter.
Oh, okay.
And the world, it's interesting. I've only gotten maybe 6 hours or so into it.
Uh-huh.
So still early days as far as RPGs go. But there's quite a few different skills you can level up. And there's lots of little different, like, kind of little touches to the world that make it nice, that make it better. There's a lot of charm to the game. So things like, you know, you'd be walking around, say, in Dragon Age, and you can't jump over this chest-high wall, or there's maybe like a ladder being held up by a rope or something.
Right.
You can't affect that. You know, right. It's just part of the scenery. In this game, there's no indication that you could interact with that, but you can.
If you
pull out your weapon and slice the rope, the ladder will fall, allowing you access to somewhere else.
Huh.
But it doesn't say, you know, press X to do this. And it's not very common, but it happens enough for you to think, oh, that's pretty cool.
That does sound cool. Because it's on PC as well. Huh. Are you playing on PC or?
PS3. I literally can't play anything on my laptop.
Oh, right. You've become a PS3 guy.
I'm just bound at the moment.
Right.
Once I get my proper desktop, I'll be back on the PC sphere.
Okay, can't wait. Yeah. Need you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm looking forward to playing EU3. I do really want to play that. Really, really good.
Well, I my offer. If you need some, hints or, how things work, let me know.
No, that'd be great. Yeah.
I'm not a...
When I played it, I got really stuck. Because I was having trouble how to make people move between different territories.
Ah, yeah.
Because I don't know how I was doing it. I can't remember. But I was making them do it and then cancelling it by accident or something. I wasn't confirming the move or something.
Right.
So I was never getting anywhere. And then I kept on doing it. Even though I'd figured out how to work out how to do it, I'd forget. And that I'd done it wrong. And and then it'd be like a couple of months later, or like a year later, and they'd been sitting in the sea. and I'm like, oh crap, you should go fight this war over here, you know what I mean? You'd be like 6 months too late, kind of thing.
All right. Yeah.
But that's the kind of thing. It's just being completely unfamiliar with how the game system works. I mean, if you play an RTS, you know how RTS has worked, don't you? You know
what I mean? Yep.
Whereas these kind of turn-based strategies are completely different to how they are for the Galciv or,
Well, this is an RTS.
No. But what I mean, the control style.
I know, I'm teasing. It's just really slow. It's really slow RTS.
It's real-time, but in slow motion.
Real-time forever. That game I played was so...
I can't believe you managed to reform the Holy Roman Empire. That's going to be like one of the hardest things to do in EU3.
It is really hard, and I kind of felt like I had to game it a little bit.
Okay.
To get it to happen. Basically, you get these imperial points when you release nations, right? So, like, if you take, so let's say for instance, I conquer and annex, Brandenburg, right, which is a small country. If you release them, because they're members of the Holy Roman Empire, you get points.
Okay. So you're capturing and releasing them.
So what I ended up doing was I had a bunch of them in the late stages of the game, and I calculated out, okay, if I release this many then I'll get this many points and I can put forth another, because I got to like 1720, like with 100 years left.
Yeah.
Right? And this is where I was like, hell, I don't know how I'm going to be able to do this. Because, you know, one of the things is all these reforms kind of start limiting your options on how you can get points. So,
okay.
So it's harder and harder to get points, which this is what makes reforming the Holy Roman Empire so hard. And what I ended up doing is I calculated how many of these nations I could free, right? Set free, basically. And how many points I would get, and how many I would need, how many more reforms I needed to do in order to get to the end. And that felt a little gamey to me. But, you know, whatever.
So you're playing the game rather than playing your game.
Kind of. Right. Yeah. But, I mean, again, just the way, just that mechanic, the way it's put together, it's probably not the best way to do it. I can't think of a better way, but, I mean, what they're trying to model is that you just can't go in and make all these changes willy-nilly. You have to build up, and it's called Imperial Authority, now that I remember. And you have to build up your authority in certain ways in order to kind of push these changes through. And, sometimes, and I had this happen to me earlier on, is you can, if you don't have everything lined up perfectly, when you try to push a reform through, it won't take. And there's... Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of hard work and hard-earned points down the drain, because it takes a point no matter what. And, yeah. So it's not all, it's, you know, the thing about the game is you're not all powerful. You can't just go in and do whatever you want. There are other forces
events
at work.
Come and do overtake you.
Right. And there are other forces at work that, you know, these other nations actually behave a lot like, you know, other players. And, you know, if you start acting in, you know, against their interests, they will take notice and come after you. Which is, I got one of the things I like about it so much is, there's so much I like about it. But I think I'm done with EU3 for a while. Because that game was just, it obsessed me.
You kind of played past the point where you would normally kind of have a break and stuff.
Well, one of the things about EU3 is, in most of my games, if you play, especially if you play for conquest, which I wasn't really doing in this game, but if you play where you're trying to take the most land that you possibly can, there gets to be a point where you're so powerful that the end of the game is a foregone conclusion. There's just no way anybody can catch up, and there's no confluence of events that's going to cut you down enough. And usually those games I just end up quitting when I get to that point, when it's just like, well, there's just no way I'm going to lose, right? There's no way I'm going to be second place on this, you know, at the end of the game. But I try to play this game where I never went to war without a cause. I never went to war that would cost me stability unless, you know, the opportunity was just so awesome that it was worth it, right? Because you can really play, you can really game it a lot. In the game, you're supposed to only declare war when you have a valid casus belli, right? And if you don't, you can declare war in another nation without it, but it costs you stability.
Yeah.
And stability is an important resource in the game because it makes your trade work better, your production work better, your tax gathering work better. And your revolt risk be lower. I mean, there's a lot of things that are tied to this stability statistic. And so you don't want to spin it off willy-nilly. And it takes a long time for you to gain it back. And it's pretty expensive. But, you know, if you're playing, you know, you can play the game successfully at a low stability. It's just harder to do. But then you can just declare wars whenever you want to if you don't really care about it. So I kind of put some boundaries around my game so that
you couldn't just go ahead and do whatever you wanted.
Yeah, I couldn't do that. I couldn't do whatever I wanted to do. I had to have there had to be good, valid reasons. So you had to wait until a nation would provoke you, or you provoked a nation into provoking you. So you could.
I presume that there are ways to do that as well. You know, if you can sour diplomatic relations or maybe like trade relations or something to make them declare war.
If you have production centers, you can embargo them so they can't trade at your production center.
Okay.
Trade center. You can insult them. which sours your relationships. There's like every nation has a relation with every other nation, and it's a number from negative 100 to a positive, no, negative 200 to a positive 200. And zero is perfectly neutral. And if you get below that, then they don't like you. And if you get to negative 200, then they really don't like you. Okay. And in some cases, they'll do something like insult you back, in which case that gives you a causus belli. So you can kind of poke at them sometimes. you know, and they'll be less likely to do stuff like that if you're bigger than they are. So when I started getting become really huge, then a lot of these little bitty, piddly, you know, German states would
pay lip service to you kind of thing.
Yeah, they would just let me push them around, but they would never do anything that would let me go after them.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense though, doesn't it?
Yeah. The other kind of boundary I put on myself was no colonization. So I didn't go, I stayed only in Europe.
Okay.
So everybody else was going out and getting colonies, and I decided not to go that way. Colonies are, they start out being a vast hindrance to your economic system, but eventually they develop enough that they start to really help you out. And I figured that would be a bit of a handicap if I didn't go after any external colonies. Mm-hmm. It was pretty funny because Normandy ended up being a state, but it got totally kicked out of Europe and ended up taking over most of Canada.
Canada!
Which is bizarre, right? Same thing happened to
Prussia. That makes sense, though, really.
Well, same thing happened to Prussia. Prussia got kicked out of Europe and ended up being a Central African nation.
Wow. You just, like, these kind of things you just wouldn't even think of, you know what I mean? Because these states don't exist.
Yeah, And, you know, and the cool thing is it seems totally nonsensical when you say it like that, but if you play the game and you follow through it, it's like it totally made sense.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, Prussia went out and it colonized a couple of African provinces, and then they got into a couple of bad wars in Europe, and just about the time their colonies became full-fledged, you know, provinces of their empire, and so they transferred their capital down into Africa, and then when they lost their last bit of European territory, that's where they were. It's pretty great. It's pretty great stuff. So,
it's funny. The interesting thing about like things like UE3 is that you don't realize how fractured, just a couple of hundred years ago, the whole of the known world was.
Yeah.
You don't think about it. Like to me, like now France is France. You didn't realize it was like several different warring states.
Right.
All with different kind of political and religious kind of alliances.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You don't get a sense of that at all.
Because it's not taught to you, is it? I don't know about you in history. We were taught about English history and World War II.
Yeah.
You know, if we were lucky, they didn't teach you about kind of, you know, about how complicated Europe was.
Yes. Indeed. I mean, you don't. You're right. France is France. Spain is Spain.
Yeah.
Right. And the United Kingdom is United Kingdom.
Yeah. Even things like Rome total war. Like you learn about the Carthaginians and stuff. I mean, it's much farther back, obviously. But you know, these factions in EU3 and Victoria 2, they really feed into things like why the First World War happened and stuff like that. Because there were still lingering, you know, pressures
Well, there's a lot of resentment. There's a lot of territorial, you know, things lingering on, you know, from history.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm listening to this podcast called The History of Rome, which is excellent, by the way, if you like Roman history.
Okay. Send me a link. Yeah, send me a link.
Sure. But it's fascinating. But it's very interesting to see how much of the stuff that they kind of, because they didn't really come up with anything, they just kind of engineered it and streamlined it so that it was palatable to everybody.
Okay.
It's interesting to see how much stuff we still do today was developed back then by the Romans.
Yeah, you know, like sewers and stuff like that. They haven't really changed.
Well, and this guy, you know, he got married in the middle of the podcast. I just finished one, and he was talking about, you know, he said he took a week off from the history part and just said, you know, here's, you know, talk about Roman marriage customs. I was like, wow. All the kind of odd marriage customs that we have today, not all of them, but a lot of them are derived from, you know, Roman marriage customs.
Really? Wow.
Carrying the bride across the threshold of your house, for instance, yeah, is a Roman custom.
Wow.
Because it was considered bad luck if the bride tripped going across the threshold to her new house.
Oh, okay.
And so the bridegroom would carry his wife across so that that couldn't happen.
That's,
I mean, just
cool.
just a minor little thing, but I mean, there's a ton of stuff like that. And then, yeah, how fractured things were in Europe in medieval times. You know, I remember my first kind of exposure to that was when I was reading, what was I reading? I was reading Three Musketeers, right? About Alexandre Dumas. And he talks about, you know, the Gascons and you know, I don't know where Gascony is, right? I was probably 17 at the time or something. It's like, and it turns out that, yeah, the Gascons were always felt like they should be an independent country and were kind of chafing under the rule of France. That's something that you don't really ever get exposed to in school. But, you know,
yeah.
When you play Europa Universalis III, when you go down there and you conquer those provinces, you have the ability to make that country.
I've been looking at KOTOR, the MMO, and I'm not interested because of they keep making things more advanced in the past.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean? It's like the world keeps getting better and better, and it's as if they've had some kind of, maybe they did. I mean, maybe I don't know the whole. I'm not a big Star Wars, nerd. Maybe they had like a big apocalypse and they all kind of regressed a couple of thousand years after the last, because they did, because you know, they all ended up in like really crappy ships and stuff, and they're all, you know.
Yeah. Well, not to get too far afield here, but I always thought it's stupid. Obviously the first, you know, the prequels or the first three or whatever you want to view them, I always thought it was silly that they made all that so close to the original, you know, 4, 5, and 6.
Uh-huh,
I always thought it would be much more interesting to have it be, you know, 100 years or 200 years or,
yeah,
1,000 years or something. It's like we've been under this, because they do hint in the first movies that they've been under Imperial control, you know,
for a long time,
under the boot, right?
Yeah, not just 20
years. But then
years.
It turns out, well, it's only been 20 years. Yeah. It's not been, you know.
And you think about it as well, there's no real reason why Darth Vader, aided by the Force and his machines, couldn't have lived a very long time.
Right.
And Darth Sidious knows the secret of resurrection or something, doesn't he? Or eternal life or something.
I think he sold that to turn.
Well, I know he did, but I think his previous master knew the whole secret, and possibly he only knew partial. But like, you know, there's justification there for him to live a long time.
I just thought it makes you know the middle three more interesting if they would have been.
Yeah, it's like finally they're escaping from under the thumb.
And then the first stories become, you know, you're playing, it's the Empire, right? There's no Republic. You don't have any of this nonsense, Senate nonsense. It's all, you know, the Emperor, and he's always been around, and you know, Darth Vader is just the latest, you know, hotshot general.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it seems like it makes for a better story. That's how I always thought about that universe up until I saw the first movie and realized that, yeah, this is 20 years beforehand. Yeah. You know, it kind of takes a lot of the minutes out of the Empire in my mind.
They really probably should have done the sequels, you know, the last three films, rather than the prequels.
Yeah,
because,
I agree.
Because
they carried it forward.
Because that could have at least made more sense to have better technology afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to get off into Star Wars nerd
rage. It's always simmering. It's always there. Whatever we're doing, you know, we'd be there having a coffee and work. All of a sudden, fuck, you know, what's his name? The Jar Jar Binks.
Jar Jar Binks sucks. He's an ass. What the fuck?
It's always boiling under the surface. Just before I forget to actually have that in, the show will just like cut off. We're like, and that's silence. It's like, well, that's it. What?